Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Good morning. Welcome to Sogcast number 14. And today we are honored to have as our guest, Lieutenant Colonel Mitch Utterback. And we're taking a different tack from here from our normal SOG stories because this is an opportunity for us to take a unique look at SOG history and the history from the OSS that led to Special Forces, this founding, and then later into SOG. And I'm going to turn it over to you, Mitch, if you could start out with how you and I met now over 20 years ago when you were working with Colonel Bank and his family prior to us losing him, and you had your official function with 10th Group at that time, and you were kind enough to come out to our Special Forces Association Chapter 75 meetings, and we had a lot to learn from there, and you've been giving us information ever since. We appreciate that. Welcome today, sir.
Thanks, Tilt. Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Indeed.
And I'm grateful to be here. Let me add some accuracy to what you just said.
Pretty please. That's so why we paid a big bucks.
Yeah, so I was a captain in 19th Special Forces out of Los Alamitos, Alpha Company, right. 5th Battalion, 19th Group. I was prior enlisted in 10th Group, but I never want to pass over my 19th Group National Guard Special Forces background.
Indeed.
So I was a 19th Group guy when you and I met, and I was living in San Diego, drilling in Los Alamitos, and came to meet Colonel and Catherine Bank through the Special Forces Association. And that's a reason why I would encourage any young guys listening to this that are members of the regiment or recently ETS'd to join the SFA. It's not just a bunch of old farts, even though if you look around, you might think it is. Well, I guess it is.
We have many.
I'm here with Tilt.
But the oldest fart.
I'm 60 myself. But it's a great way to connect with your history of the Special Forces. And through my membership in the SF Association, I met Tilt, I met Colonel Bank, I met Catherine Bank, and that began a relationship with the Bank family that continued to this day with their daughters.
Indeed. I remember that one time in particular, I think it was either his 99th or his 100th birthday, we gathered outside. He spoke to us, says, "Troops, I want to speak to you." And he spoke to us about living and moving forward in life. It was just like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
And you were there for that. So yeah, it was a great day.
I remember every interaction with him. I remember his voice.
He had a voice kind of like this. I never agreed with the Pentagon.
Indeed.
And that's the way he talked. And he was literally the founding father of Special Forces, a living hero and a legend, and somebody who we all have taken as a mentor whose life and legacy we try to carry on in. Until you do that, and I'm endeavoring to do that also.
And so we do that courtesy of Jocko Willink, who I failed to acknowledge in my opening, but we're here courtesy of Jocko Willink Productions, but thank you.
Well, that's nice. I'm
indeed.
That's we're grateful for the benefit of him allowing us to be on the air.
Indeed.
So, yeah, in the late 1990s, early 2000s, I volunteered to be the Bank family liaison to the active duty. Mostly because of the standing contingency plan for final honors to be rendered to Colonel Bank upon his passing. There was a plan written at Fort Bragg that was to be executed by 1st Group out of Fort Lewis because they were the West Coast Active Duty Special Forces Group. But I was the closest SF officer to the Bank family, albeit National Guard still. I was the liaison to the Bank family and to 1st Group for whatever would happen.
Indeed.
We did in-progress reviews every 6 months of that plan. I regularly visited the Bank family, as with you, and went to the Christmas parties at their assisted living facility.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Catherine was independent living, and the Colonel was assisted living. And anytime there was a function with the Banks, we were there, including the Colonel and Mrs. Bank coming out to Camp Pendleton to watch A Company do some CQB training.
Right.
Now, that was a real big deal. I was at work as a contractor at Naval Special Warfare Command in April of 04 when I got the call from one of the daughters that the colonel had finally passed, and immediately put on my uniform and spent the next several days conducting escort for Catherine and casualty assistance officer duties for the Bank family. That was a great honor, and you and I were very closely connected at that time. And at that event is where I met Major General retired John K. Singlaub. And I remember when he walked in to the little chapel where we had some of the memorial going on, and the atmosphere changed.
It did.
It was the entrance of an American living legend and hero. On, I would almost say, respectfully, on a level even that above Colonel Bank.
Absolutely. I agree.
And it was the room was electrified. There were Medal of Honor recipients there like Roger Donlan.
Yes.
There were SAW guys there like you and others, and everybody stopped when Major General Singlaub entered. I remember
Amen.
That well.
I'll never forget it.
I remember it well, and I just had this quick opportunity to introduce myself and explain who I was and then make sure that Catherine had a, you know, something to drink or a comfortable place to sit.
Indeed.
But that was when I met him. But as a little boy, speaking of General Singlaub, I read the newspaper, two newspapers growing up in suburban Detroit, the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press every day. And I remember in the mid-'70s, '77, reading in the newspaper about President Carter being pissed off at this Major General Singlaub, who even as a young, as a teenager, I'm reading thinking, sounds like General Singlaub's on the right side of this.
Indeed.
He's just saying don't pull the troops out of Korea or the North's going to invade again. So I've had the opportunity to visit General Singlaub and tell him that I first came to learn of him while reading the newspaper in 77 in Michigan about the two-star general called to the White House, which I found out later was for a sort of a Jimmy Carter chiclet-toothed ass-chewing. And one thing in the general's book, he said that Carter never stopped smiling while he was ostensibly chewing his ass. And I thought, that must have been creepy.
Indeed.
He also, in the book, also said that I feel like everybody, he had just actually gotten dressed. You know, he just put on a suit coat.
Right.
And everybody in the White House was in polo shirts, and it wasn't a very formal White House, as the general said back then.
Indeed.
Anyway, many stories about
for a man of his stature.
Truly.
Indeed.
Yeah,
they didn't understand it, being peanut farmers and all.
Yep. So that's how you and I connected, and
Indeed.
That's my history with the Bank family. I had the privilege of staying close to Catherine long after the colonel's passing, and in 19th Group, we had to take our annual language proficiency examinations to continue to get your language pro-pay. So my first set SF language was German, and that's the one that stuck best. My other one was Arabic. But
wow.
I would, as the battalion commander of the former company that I used to be the company and ODA commander in, I would travel back to Los Alamitos to visit my troops on their drill and schedule my annual language test then. But I would also schedule lunch with Catherine Bank the day before.
Indeed.
And told her, Catherine, I'm having my German language test tomorrow. It's that time of year again.
Specken Sie durch?
Okay then, Mitch. We will only speak German for the rest of the day.
Jawohl, Kamerad.
And so we did. So it was lunch in German with Catherine Bank to
Indeed.
Lubricate my brain to be prepared to go into those language tests. And in great part, thanks to her and that training, that exercise,
Indeed.
I did well every year, thanks to Catherine.
Indeed. So with the Colonel Bank, he's our father for Special Forces, and that lineage of which Jack is such a key player, because he performed OSS missions in both World War II theaters. There aren't many OSS men that have that on their record.
That's right. That's right. It's documented only about 100 OSS veterans of the European theater volunteered for duty in the China Burma India Theater, CBI. And Aaron Bank was one of them. Jack Singlaub was one of them. And Bob Kehoe, about whom I spoke yesterday.
Yes.
He was also one of them. And Aaron was over 40 at that time.
Oh,
Colonel Bank.
Sure.
And he's remembered by the Jedbergs that I have spoke with as the oldest guy going through training at Milton Hall. And
is that right?
Keeping up. He was certainly the oldest OSS Jedburgh trainee. And impressed Sing Laub and impressed Bob Kehoe. I've talked to both of them about their memories of Aaron Bank. And it was, it made me think of Martin Sheen's line in Apocalypse Now when he's reading the dossier on Colonel Kurtz when they're in the patrol boat Riverine going up the Nung River. And Sheen has a line, something about, you know, they must have thought he was a far-out old man humping it through that course. Because, you know, Colonel Kurtz was supposedly much older, you know,
indeed,
going through airborne and, and SF. So, to paraphrase from popular culture, Aaron Bank was considered a far-out old man going through Jedburgh training at Milton Hall by guys in their early 20s, like Lieutenant Sing Laub and Tech Sergeant Kehoe.
And, you know, there's a couple of pictures of Colonel Bank where you could tell that man was in shape.
He was what we would say ripped.
Physical specimen.
For a small of stature, and I said yesterday that in my talk that Colonel Bank was what would be considered today a personal trainer in the 1930s for rich people in Europe. He called it he was a physical culturist. That's an old-timey phrase for a personal trainer or a guy who makes a living by being fit and teaching other people how to be fit. So quite literally, he remains a role model of mine to be an old guy. Like I said, I'm 60, but I don't want to be looked at as, man, Mitch was a Green Beret, sure has let himself go to hell since he got out. You know, got to keep doing it. Colonel Bank is looking down on us saying, you guys better stay in shape. You Green Berets, you got a reputation to uphold.
There you go. Indeed.
Yeah.
So through Colonel Bank, we move forward into the Special Forces history. And of course, during that time, Jack also had service with Spec Ops in the Korean War, which we know very little about. But that's also a part of that gradual transition where we go from the OSS that converts to become the CIA. There's that period of time where everybody appeared to drop the ball. Then the CIA gets activated again. And we had the Korean War where Jack served with valor there against the communists again.
Yeah. So as I studied every book that I could about the OSS, the Special Operations branch of the OSS, specifically the Jedburghs and the operational groups, and talking to guys like Bob Kehoe and Jack Sing Laub at the time, the last two surviving Jeds. Now it's just Jack Sing Laub.
Right.
As I read and talked to Bob and the general, I realized that the training that they went through never got dusty or rusty. And by the time I went through that Army Special Forces training 40 years later, much of it was the same.
Yeah.
Much of it was the same. And as we know in the military, people, we're all lazy. And if there's a class that's already been written, I'm not going to rewrite it. I might retype it and put my signature on it at the bottom of the training schedule. But if somebody has already figured out that the wheel is round, I ain't going to add 361 degrees to it. It's still 360
Indeed.
Degrees. So my study of our OSS history has shown me that the training that they went through stateside at the Congressional Country Club in D.C., Area B, the Catoctin Mountain Training Area, which became Camp David in Maryland, training that they went through in Catalina Island or at Camp X in Ontario, Canada, and also at Milton Hall, and then some of the long humps they did in the northern part of the U.K., was just like, that's where guys got the idea.
Yeah.
You know, that's where some of our long-range land nav came from. Special operations training, which was conducted at Mott Lake at Fort Bragg, was, as I went through it in February of 85, I didn't know that I was going through the exact same kind of training that Bank and Sing Laub and Kehoe had gone through when it came to stalking a sentry on guard duty and then sneaking up on him with a knife and taking him out silently.
And then land navigation.
Land nav.
Oh,
my gosh. You know, the land nav that you and I went through, the land nav that was being taught in the 1980s was a direct descendant of SOG land nav in Vietnam.
Yeah.
When it was It was too thick to, you know, get a bearing on a distant point.
Sure.
So it was just looking at your, you know, getting the bearing on your compass.
You're in my case, you say, you go to the Vietnamese on the team and say, here, get me here. This is our map.
See,
get me there.
Yeah, you had your Vietnamese version of a global positioning satellite.
There we go.
A human positioning system. But SF land nav training in the early 80s was directly related. And many of our cadre in the early 80s were guys that you had served with.
Sure.
So, or they were, you know, they were like the first sergeants of the training companies, and some younger guys were doing it. But, you know, I learned to follow a compass azimuth and do a pace count and always know where you're at. And that came from the long humps that they did in, you know, Scotland and Ireland to prepare them for long-range movement. And we know the OSS in World War II did some long-range movements when they got blown out of their guerrilla base.
Oh,
just
yeah.
Like what happens in Robin Sage nowadays.
Indeed.
Yeah, so to answer your question.
And Robin Sage, just for a record, is the final training phase for Special Forces today.
That's correct.
And it's been there ever since Special Forces was formed back in the early 60s.
Yeah, I work in Robin Sage as a guerrilla
today,
chief
so
now.
You're well spoken today.
Yeah, I'm a guerrilla chief, so I live it still. And I've heard cadre say that it's been around for at least 53 years. It's been named different things, but that final 2 weeks of the qualification course is a 14-day unconventional warfare, formerly known as guerrilla warfare exercise, where we Pinelanders,
are
some American special forces, come to our country to help us fight the occupation. And so now, as I work as a guerrilla chief in Robin Sage, we are doing the same things that the OSS taught the French Maquis to do in World War II. Patrolling techniques, land navigation, how to use weapons, how to conduct an ambush, how to set up a drop zone for a resupply, how to blow up a rail line, the exact same
at key
stuff.
Points with trains on them.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Same stuff. Ugh. So that, I would say Robin Sage is probably the most visual reminder that the program of instruction for modern Army Special Forces soldiers can be directly traced back to training of the OSS, specifically the Jedburghs and the 15-man operational groups.
So maybe with that, we could lead into the early 60s when Vietnam is unfolding, American involvement is escalating. In the very early 60s, the CIA was running covert operations from their own way. And then in 1964, SOG was formed. And then maybe go into that that transition there when it becomes SOG, and who Chief SOG was for more than 2 years from 1966 until August 1968.
Well, the country chose well when
Indeed.
Colonel John K. Singlaub was asked to lead, because there was no field grade officer with his credentials to lead a unit that, I guess if you looked at SOG and who they drew from and who they were working with and what their mission was, there was no dartboard to throw at and pick a name. There was one guy. It was John K. Singlaub for his OSS service in World War II in France and in China. Before the term sheep dipped was around, you know, he stayed in China for a couple of years, paying attention to how the communists and the nationalists were, which way it was going to go, specifically in Manchuria.
Sure.
His service in the conventional army during the Korean War at Outpost Harry, which is famous, you know, that was also important, that Colonel Singlaub had conventional army background and history and had been to the Command and General Staff College. He had checked all the boxes for his legitimacy and credibility in the eyes of the conventional military, like General Westmoreland. He wasn't one of you long-haired hippie green berets.
Yeah.
he was looked upon as a bona fide, highly respected, very broadly experienced conventional officer with OSS background and CIA background, and had done many of the things already, well, he had, that he was about to ask you and your teammates to go do.
Indeed.
So much to the point of leading from the front that he rode the Fulton extraction system before he asked you guys to do it.
Yeah, he was the first one. He was in his 50s at that point.
He rode it in 67, and as a colonel, again, let me borrow what I had said earlier about Colonel Bank and Martin Sheen from, you know, Colonel Singlaub was some far-out old man riding that Fulton extraction system at an age, twice the age of the guys that he was going to ask to potentially ride it.
And the Fulton extraction was designed for something to extract either key prisoners or key personnel from an LZ, and the person on the ground would be in a uniform with a hook that had a wire that extended up with a balloon, and a C-130 would come in, pick it up, and literally the man on the ground would go from 0 to 130 miles an hour in one half of a second or a pubic hair. Yeah. And Jack said, I'm not going to have my men do it until I test it.
Yeah.
Of course, the little sidebar today, he told the Air Force, after you pick me up, take me over to South China Sea. Do not go inland. They forgot. They took him inland, and they were shooting at him as he was dangling from the C-130.
You know, I've seen the photos at his house, and he's wearing like one of those N3 Bravo winter parkas.
Yes.
I think that's nomenclature. You know, he's wearing winter clothes on the ground in Vietnam because it's going to be cold up there before they haul him in. And he, there's pictures of him inside the aircraft, covered in sweat, but you can see he's already debriefing the crew chief on the thing. And for people that are listening, if you, if this sounds any bit familiar, if you've watched the John Wayne movie, The Green Berets.
And James Bond, one of the early James Bond movies had a skyhook.
Okay.
Indeed.
So the when Colonel Kirby, John Wayne, and his team capture that NVA general, and they pull him out. They pull him out by the Fulton system.
Indeed.
And so that's how where you can see it in the movie. Yeah. So we're talking about a man who's still alive at age 100, who has always been at pushing himself and the limits of his ability to do the right thing. And now, and I wouldn't really call General Singlaub a gray area operator either. He always stayed between the lines, but he was racing so far ahead of his commander's intent that sometimes they had to say, hey, Jack, I'm going to talk to you for a second.
Yeah.
But he always got the job done. God bless him.
Well, and as Chief Sog from 66 until August of 68, he fought for key things behind the scenes, such as getting CH-43 helicopters for the King Bees, South Vietnamese Air Force.
For them. Mm-hmm.
And then A-1 Sky Raider support, which he had to go through the Air Force. And there's many a famous background battle over assets that would be there for the recon teams in SOG, on the ground, in Laos or Cambodia, that Jack was a critical player in. So by the time I get there in May of 68, those assets are in place. We don't even realize the battles that are going on behind the scenes, inter-service battles to get those assets. But he did it.
Amen. He understood, you know, in the Corrèze Department of France during his Team James Jedburgh mission, it was him and his two teammates, you know, with his French Maquis, but surrounded by Germans. The only air support flying over the Corrèze Department were German planes. And he was getting bombed by HE-111s or strafed by FW-190s. So his experience in the late summer of 1944 forever stayed with him. What it feels like when you're on the ground deep behind enemy lines and you have none of your own air support. Even though, arguably, we had air superiority over the Luftwaffe then. But he was pretty far into France. So I would say, knowing him and knowing his history, now speaking to you about when he got you the air support and your partner forces their air support, that stems from he had been at a point in his life where he didn't have any.
That's true.
And he didn't want you boys to not.
When you and I have read his book, I know when I read his book, Hazardous Duty by John K. Singlaub, that part where he's on the ground and getting strafed by the Nazis. I'm going, oh my God.
Yep.
This is what it's like to be on the wrong end of TAC Air.
Yeah.
Because we always thought, hey, you know, we're cool here with our TAC Air, but I just can't imagine being strafed.
He's been bombed by the twin-engine Heinkel 111s.
Right.
And he's been strafed by the Focke-Wulf 190 fighter plane. So he has been on the receiving end of enemy air power and didn't want you guys to be without friendly air power.
Oh, yeah. And again, this is one of the little sidebars with Jack. Before he entered the Army, he's at UCLA. He came up against the communists who were at UCLA.
Oh, yeah.
And then even with the French underground in the OSS, he came up against the Russian version of the support of the French. And it's just like, you could just see him pulling his hair out. And reading that those chapters on hazardous duty was just amazing.
Yeah. And that's something we had to do, you know, during World War II, with many of those partisan groups were communist aligned, and fortunately France didn't go communist, but Yugoslavia did go communist in their own brand. Yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah, there's probably still communists at UCLA.
So getting back, you know, there's no question in my mind about that.
Professor.
Yes. So getting into the SOG side of things, would there be anything else in that period from 66 to 68? Because I know that even when he left, he stayed in touch with the man who followed him, Colonel Steve Cavanaugh,
mm-hmm.
because he supported him, cared about that part. And then even though he had a new command, there's Jack still caring about his prior command as well as his new command as he moved forward in his career.
Yes. Colonel Singlob's experience leading SOG, he was always comfortable in the interagency environment because he had it in his blood. You know, if there was a guy in civilian clothes, you know, Colonel Singlob spoke the same language. You know, he was never going to be too awed by a CIA officer coming to talk to him. I mean, I've seen it myself. Sometimes regular SOF is a little bedazzled, you know, when there's a CIA mission coming down. But not Colonel Singlob. He'd been one of them. He had his union card, and there was nothing that they could pull. And I'm sure that there were times when he said, bad idea, come back to me when you got more information before I ask my boys to go do this.
Indeed.
I'm sure that was the case. And something else was important. Westmoreland liked him. You know, Westmoreland really appreciated him, and Miss Joan has told me, the general's wife, that General Westmoreland, after the war, had said to Joan Singlob that whenever I had a difficult mission, I would ask that young whippersnapper husband of yours, Colonel Singlob, and I knew he could always get the job done with SOG.
Right, and just for the record,
I don't know if that's Westmoreland's voice or not.
I like it. Just for the record, General Westmoreland was a supreme commander for our U.S. troops in Vietnam for at least 4 or 5 years
before General Abrams.
General Abrams took over in the middle of 68. The tank command came in.
So when you when you're a CIA soft conventional guy, like I said, Colonel Singlob had all the right creds. But to be so well accepted by your conventional 4-star, you know, highest level commander, I see that as a major accomplishment and a major benefit to SOG also, that the big battle space owner, Westmoreland, had good relations with the SOG commander, Colonel Singlob.
Because one of the benefits that SOG had, we had their own supply system set up with Cisco that was in Okinawa, I think. And Jack helped them to upgrade what they were doing there. And that's just another sidebar to all this. Okay, we got the guys on the ground, helped get the assets, and then the supplies. We had any kind of weapon we needed, it came out of there.
Well, as you know, in Army SF, one of our key core beliefs, and we know this, is we need external support. We need conventional support to accomplish our mission. You know, it's one of the soft truths, I believe. And, or is it one of the soft imperatives? Somebody will know.
It's soft, but it's good moving forward.
But it's We need conventional support to accomplish what we must. And Colonel Singlob, with his good relations with the big four-star, he knew that. And I wouldn't be surprised if these things that have been codified in our modern soft today, we can go straight back to how Colonel Singlob ran SOG and his relationships with General Westmoreland proved that you got to have good relations and you need help from the conventional forces.
Indeed. And that, again, maybe we can break down a little bit of that unique training, too, from the languages, working with indigenous personnel. And that's all part of things that go back to OSS lineage there. It's carried forward because today nobody works as well on the ground with people from any country. Because today we have, what, over 90 different countries that SF troops are involved in, working in an operational framework that's structured, that goes back to OSS, to the SOG days.
Yeah, it's not a coincidence that modern special forces go to language school as soon as they are awarded their Green Berets. So the end of the pipeline is, you make it through Robin Sage, about a week later, 10 days, you graduate and you get your beret, and you were just out there, I believe, in April.
Indeed.
For one of those ceremonies. And then you do your language training. And you know before you go to Robin Sage what group you're going to and what your language is going to be. And no young man or woman enlists for SF training now without the knowledge that you're going to go to language school at the end of this before you go to your ODA, your Special Forces team. Let's go back to 1943.
Let's.
And at Camp Crowder, Missouri, for the Signal School, or Fort Polk, Louisiana, or Fort Benning, Georgia. And I mention these three Army posts because Camp Crowder was where Bob Kehoe heard the call for volunteers for the OSS.
Oh, that's right. That's it.
Where Aaron Bank was at Fort Polk, Louisiana. And Lieutenant Singlob was at Fort Benning, Georgia.
Georgia.
But all three of these men and all of our American OSS guys heard some kind of loudspeaker announcement or some kind of typed
notice?
Paper, type notice in the company message board that said there will be a briefing for men interested in immediate overseas assignment for hazardous duty. You must be willing to volunteer for parachute training, if not already airborne qualified, 2 years college preferred, and competency or fluency or 2 years of high school or above language training in a European language. So it was, before you knew you were getting into the OSS.
In the middle of World War II.
The recruiting said, we want you to have language ability.
Indeed.
And there is another genealogical trace right back from today.
Yes.
To the recruitment of our guys for the OSS. We wanted you to have some language ability because that proved that your brain and your tongue were going to be able to work in a foreign language and speak it. And there was language training conducted. I know at Milton Hall there was French language training conducted for the Jeds going into France.
And you've seen this firsthand as a commander in different commands under your time in other countries, where that ability to have a language brings you so close in a way to bond with indigenous personnel. You did that. I had an interpreter. But for your side, you're there speaking the language.
Yeah, Tilt. I've done it. I went to DLI for German.
Right.
When I was an E6 staff sergeant, and was then recruited for our special mission unit in West Berlin, then called Physical Security Support Element Berlin. Many people call it DET A.
Indeed.
And the great book by Jim Stetzkel, Special Forces Berlin, is a great story to read about.
Yes, our first major book on DET A.
Yeah. So I had just come out of German language school, and I had some before that. So being in West Berlin in a unit that was there to conduct unconventional warfare in the event that the balloon went up. Speaking German enabled me to blend in because we were relaxed grooming standards, civilian clothes. So my German allowed me to not be tagged as an American soldier. because there are plenty of GIs running around West Berlin. But we distanced ourselves from them and didn't look like them and certainly tried not to talk like them. So not just through foreign language where we are able to better establish rapport and accomplish our missions. In some units that exists today still, having that foreign language ability allows you to maybe not be taken as an American right away so that you can move, swim amongst the fishes.
Indeed.
Know?
And even one of the little things they would teach you would be when you eat like the Europeans do. We're not like America where you cut the food with your knife and your fork and then you put the fork down and pick it up with your right hand. Whereas as Europeans, you just keep the fork there.
Well, I got you. Again, that goes back to the OSS.
Yes.
All the way back to the OSS. And there is a movie, a Hollywood movie, that shows the foreign culture competencies and how they can go poorly for you. You know, the 1947 movie 13 Rue Madeleine with James Cagney.
I remember it.
There's a scene where one of the agents is... who has been told not to do it, is using his knife and fork the wrong way, and he is compromised, and he's arrested by the Gestapo, and he winds up dead, and his team has to go to ground and escape and evade. A more modern version of this failure of cultural competency is the scene in Inglourious Basterds, where Michael Fassbender orders three glasses for whiskey, but he raises his three fingers in the American and British style, where your thumb is held down and you put up the first three fingers. And the Gestapo officer busts him for it by saying you used the three wrong. You know, in German, three is the one is your thumb. So when I saw that at the movie theater, I said out loud, oh, crap, that's not good.
Yeah.
because I had literally been trained in that myself.
But like those are the little things that are so critical when you're on the ground. And each culture has little idiosyncrasies that SF trains for before they get on the ground.
So our OSS guys operating in Europe had that training. I received it myself in the 80s and employed it, lived it live in West Berlin. And then nowadays, as a guerrilla chief in Robin Sage, I'm ensuring that cultural awareness and cultural competency is being imparted into the students that come through my lane. Oh. And because we're a foreign country, I'm a Pinelander. I'm not an American. So I can say things to them just to show them that, hey, that's not how it works here in Pineland. Why are you being so American? Many examples, but there's something as simple as and I wouldn't say it to the sergeant, you know, in Pineland. I say it to the captain.
Indeed.
Captain, while your sergeant was teaching a class, why did he have mouth tobacco in his mouth? And why was he spitting on the ground while he was teaching us a class about the 240 machine gun? Here in Pineland, we find that highly offensive when you're talking to us and you're spitting at our feet. Are you meaning to offend us? So I can say this in character, in
Indeed.
Role.
Sure.
And tell the team leader, hey, you know, Copenhagen isn't appropriate when you're teaching a class in a foreign country when you're spitting.
Yeah.
So those are just one of the little things.
The most surprising thing that I carried with me today from Vietnam was this: never pat a child on the head or another person, because we were taller than a lot of the Vietnamese. And as Americans, hey, kid, you know, you put your hand on them or something, particularly children.
Uh-huh.
And he said, never, ever do it. It's that little cultural thing.
Yeah, right.
It's like just like what you're saying.
Yep.
Good God.
Yep.
And thank God I learned it, because I was just like, hey, come on over here. We're on the same team.
So
no,
many things.
No.
But we in the Army Special Forces, we pride ourselves on trying to be the best within our nation's military at understanding a foreign culture and the right things to do and the wrong things to do. And as you mentioned earlier, speaking their language is so important. Speaking it a little bit is important. Especially important is to know, pay attention to the little nuances of what they say, to show that, hey, I'm paying attention to you guys and I'm respectful of your culture. Case in point, when Iraqis sit down, you know, in a comfortable chair after a hard day of planning operations, you know, we Americans, we sit down and we might say something like, ugh, man, it feels good.
Yeah.
Well, when my experience during the Battle of Basra, when we were planning, you know, briefing and planning the missions every night, the Iraqi officers would sit down and they just kind of say to themselves, oh, ya Allah.
Ya Allah, oh God. And so I noticed that, and I just started doing it myself. Just quietly, you know, yeah. I'd sit down, I'm the one American Special Forces officer in a room with 20 Iraqi Special Forces officers, counterterrorism service, ISOF guys. And I'd sit down, oh, ya Allah. And a couple days later, you know, Iraqi general would come to me,
Major Mitch, you talk like Iraqi. You are Iraqi. You are not American. You are Iraqi.
And you speak the Iraqis to a little bit. That help?
Enough. Yes. Enough. Can you, that, and Arabic was my other language.
Yes,
and,
I know.
And I focus on the operational aspects of it. But also, like I just mentioned, the little idiomatic expressions that they say. And this is a demonstration of respect for them.
Sure.
And their language and their culture. And indeed their religion. Because I just said Allah. I said, oh God. So this binds you closer, brings you, bonds you, and binds you, the three B's, closer to your counterparts. And
three B's.
You can accomplish so much more when they look at you and think, this guy gets it, man. We love him.
Indeed.
You know, he gets it.
Before we move on to it, I thought your history is so interesting to me. Before we do that, I'd like to close up with any final thoughts on our favorite living OSS General, General Singlaw, because we visited him for his 100th birthday. You were there. Yeah. And, of course, the Special Operations Association's Vice President Mike Taylor hand-delivered greetings.
Yeah.
And, you know, just talking to him, when you get in, away from the people and start talking about operations, he locks in.
Yes, he does.
To this day, at 100 years old, and you just know he's with you on that.
He sure is.
And so you've done more with him along those lines. Any final thoughts about that?
Yeah, sure.
Please.
He loves company. He loves to look at books that have the history in it. And it's sitting with him that we have determined that not all books are right. You know, he's researchers.
Right.
There are OSS history books written now that aren't quite right because they just went along maybe with the photo and thought that they knew what it was. But one important thing, there's a photo in his own book.
Yes.
And there's a photo in some other books that have a picture of him, and it's often captioned as him interrogating a German prisoner, Team James. But in that photo on the far left is Adrian Wise, who was the commander of Jedburgh Team Frederick, Bob Kehoe's commander. And the photo with Wise and Singlaub could have only been taken in October of 1944 when Adrian Wise and Jack Singlaub re-infiltrated France to establish an intel network and reestablish an intel network in Brittany.
And the key word there is re-infiltrated, the second time.
Yeah. Most people don't know that Jack Singlaub had two missions in France. The second one in the first week of October, only a week long. But he and Adrian Wise landed in a rubber raiding craft in the village of Saint-Briac to reactivate some intel networks to keep dibs on the 30,000 Germans that were cut off in the Brittany Peninsula. Just to know in case they were going to move against the supply lines coming out of the Normandy beachheads. But he has pointed out to me in books that there's Adrian Wise, and this was in October. This caption is wrong. And I think, man, General, like I'm the only guy in the world. Now everybody listening and everybody that came to the presentation yesterday, now people know that, hey, let's nitpick that photo in the future when we see it in new books, and hopefully
Indeed.
We'll get it right. But he has shown me that history is can still be incorrect. Even when his life is so well documented, it can still be incorrect. He loves to look at books that have pictures of OSS weapons and operations or photos from Outpost Harry.
Yeah.
He loves to revisit photographically his military service, and he certainly appreciates when an SF guy who owns a business wants to send him some swag, whether it's protein powder from Alpha Elite Performance or some leather patches from Naylor Forge or artwork by Frank Allen or a coin by John Joyce, you
Indeed.
Name it. He likes getting that stuff. He loves to know that his service is remembered, appreciated, and there are guys still carrying on his legacy, fighting to make our country the best it can be, and our military likewise.
Indeed, and George Sternberg, who ran recon with Spike Team Oregon out of FOB-1 and later CCN, had one of the Jason Hardy SOG recon books, his pictures on the front page, and we gave Jack the copy of that, and he just sat there asking George questions.
Great.
And it was just, like you said, this is one of those moments. And fortunately, the history there was accurate.
Yeah,
we didn't get any Jack corrections.
Good. Yeah.
But what I'd like to do is we head down the home stretch of our interview here. And again, thank you for taking time for your schedule. Is to talk a little bit more about your history, because it's been fascinating. When you were in Iraq, you served there.
Yeah.
And again, you used your SF skills, trained during the time on the ground. And then also, after you're out of the service, you went back for a second time as a journalist. But first, talk about a little bit about your time there, because you made connections that were wonderful, and then you went back and reconnected. Take it from there, sir.
Yeah, thanks.
Please.
In 07-08, our National Guard company was activated in
SF.
Los Alamitos, right? And we were attached to 1st Battalion 5th Group at Fort Campbell for their Iraq deployment. So our company, 5th Group, wound up having one more Special Forces company than they needed. Of course, us. We were the Tuskegee Airmen. So National Guard guys, we're going to have the company headquarters advise Hilla SWAT in Hilla. And we're going to take your other ODAs and we're going to have them advise different Iraqi special operations type units. And it turned out to be like the coolest mission for an SF company, I believe, during that time.
And could I interject a second with a question? I've talked to some recent SF Iraq veterans who said, I believe it's that unit that today is one of the best units in Iraq. Is that the same unit?
Well, Hilla SWAT has been absorbed into a division, the Emergency Response Division.
Right, okay.
Under the Ministry of the Interior. But the Hilla SWAT guys have maintained sort of team integrity, and they're a cohort battalion now. So they are a battalion of the Emergency Response Division, but they still love their Hilla SWAT history.
Indeed.
And when I was with them, many of these old guys from 07 in Hilla recognized me, and I recognized them. So it was a real homecoming. I'll tell you about how I got there in a second.
Sure.
So in 07-08, A519 is in Iraq under 1-5, 1st Battalion 5th Group. ODAs are in Baghdad combat advising the Iraqi commandos, the emergency response unit. They are running training at Area 4 for the ISOF, the Iraqi Special Operations Forces.
And where would be Area 4 be in Iraq?
It's adjacent. It's in Baghdad, adjacent to Baghdad International Airport. Area 4 was sort of the special operations slice terrain close to Baghdad International Airport.
Was that the old Green Zone?
No, Green Zone is different.
That was Southwest.
Green Zone is different.
Or Southeast,
yeah.
I mean. Yeah, I'm sorry.
So, when was it? March of 08, my battalion commander said, Mitch, you guys got Hilla SWAT where we want it to be down there. We're going to let your XO, Jesse, go ahead and run the show from there. I need you to come up to Baghdad and start advising the ISOF operations officer, the S3.
And give us what that acronym stands
ISOF
for.
Is Iraqi Special Operations Forces.
Right.
They were a brigade's worth of special, you know,
yeah,
Iraq's version of Army Special Forces. So I became the advisor. I was a major, and I became the advisor to Major Haider al-Obeidi. So Haider and... So I had left General Abbas, who was the commander of Hilla SWAT. I had been his advisor for several months and left him. That was a sad parting, but we had a nice little party and were brothers. So I moved up from Hilla to Baghdad and met Major Haider. and became his advisor. Advised him for a few months, and we, in early March, Prime Minister Maliki needed to take his city of Basra back from Iranian influence and Muqtada al-Sadr's Jaish al-Mahdi. So Maliki decided to send his special units, coincidentally, all of them advised by American Special Forces.
Coincidentally,
three of the units that went down were advised by Army National Guard Special Forces. Yeah.
Yeah, one of those little gem facts that we don't hear about.
Right. So the ISOF, the commandos, specifically the commandos, the Hiliswat and the Emergency Response Unit all went to Basra, all three with ODAs from A519 in the California Army National Guard.
Yeah.
Got a lot accomplished down there in Basra. That's where I learned to say, Ya Allah, when I sat down and and really made sure that my counterpart, Major Hyder, was the hero of the battle. In other words, he did the briefings. You know, I helped him with the intel, helped him with target selection. He made the decisions, always the right one.
Indeed.
Always the right decisions, coached and mentored by his counterpart. And made sure I elevated his stature. I saw General Abbas down there in Basra, leading Hiliswat. In the summer, in the midsummer of 08, it was time to rotate back to the States, and I told Abbas and I told Hyder, brothers, I will return. I promise you I will return, whether in uniform or not, I am coming back. You have my promise.
And wasn't that one of the bitter sidebars of Spec Ops, when it's that moment in time you got to get on the plane and leave behind your indigenous troops you're working with?
You've done it yourself. You know exactly how it feels.
Brutal.
Every SOG guy listening feels that. Every American that has had close counterpart that had to say goodbye, you feel that bittersweet parting. But I was blessed in 2016 to be able to keep the promise. I had retired in 15, and I decided I was going to knock out a master's in journalism at CU Boulder. And for my thesis, my master's thesis, I didn't want to do something lame.
Indeed.
You know, like write a paper and take a few pictures.
You're getting some edumacation.
I told my I told my professors I had an idea. And before I did it, I reached out through cutouts, because I wasn't in direct contact with Hyder and Abbas after I came back.
Right.
Because to have a top secret clearance, one of the questions that the background investigators ask you is, do you have any ongoing and continuous close personal relationships with anybody, any foreign nationals, or some word, something like that?
Yeah, God forbid.
So I wanted to be able to say yes. So, I mean, I love these guys, but I didn't keep in touch with them because I wanted to keep my TS clearance. But when I got out in 15, I started thinking about what I wanted to do for my thesis in 16. Reached out through some people and established contact, eventually directly, with General Abbas and now General Hyder. So I was shocked to see that they were still alive.
Yeah.
After almost 10 years of running and gunning for their country. They had the Iraqi military, even though it was poorly led in 2014 and ran away from ISIS, the Iraqi government was smart enough to keep their special operations units kind of in reserve, not throw them away like cannon fodder. But in 2016, when the biggest city, Mosul, needed to be retaken, I was very pleasantly surprised to learn that General Abbas, leading the Emergency Response Division, and General Hyder, leading the Iraqi Counterterrorism Service, had been selected as the two ground force commanders for the push into Mosul. And I said to myself, holy crap. Abbas and Hyder are the GFCs for Mosul, my two brothers. And I realized at that moment that, wait a second, there's no American who has ever advised both of these guys during the same deployment, unless somebody's listening said, well, I advised Abbas and Hyder too during my deployment. I haven't heard that.
Yeah.
So I realized, holy crap, my access and placement, I think, is going to be pretty unique. I reached out to them and said, brothers, I'd like to come join you in your fight against Daesh for a couple of weeks at the end of December, early January. I'm working on a master's in journalism, and I would like to document your fight for my master's thesis.
They replied back, "Brother, so good to hear from you. You can come to Mosul. You can ride into battle in my Humvee with me."
That was my general boss accent.
Indeed, yes.
So I told my professors, hey, I have permission to go to Mosul, Iraq, embed with the Iraqi forces that are right up against ISIS. And I'd like to do my master's thesis on the fight to liberate Mosul from ISIS occupation by embedding with the Iraqi units that are doing the fighting. They had obviously never had a student ask them that before. I said, by the way, I'm going anyway. I've already bought the plane tickets on Google Flights. I've already reserved a hotel in Erbil on Booking.com. I'm going.
Yeah.
Okay, Mitch. Yeah. So they were very supportive. You know, once I picked their three right thesis advisors anyway, guys that already liked me.
Yes.
I had taken classes from. So I did my own pre-mission training.
Yeah.
Before I went, I went down to Fort Carson, and even as a vet, I could get vaccines if I needed them. So I got whatever shots that I needed. I did some combat casualty, you know, some first aid train up. I took some more Iraqi Arabic.
Refreshers.
Refresher specific to the trip that I was going to be taking. I collected some gear. I practiced with cameras. I got new body armor. I contacted other people that had been there to ask for their tactics, techniques, and procedures about getting into the airport, where to stay, how to get to Mosul, what kind of kit you needed, all that stuff. Literally did, interviewed people that I, BBC guys, you know, asked them, hey, how'd you do this? Fox News people, how'd you do it? Learned what countries to not transit through, which I'd already done before I bought my ticket. My flight was from Denver to Frankfurt to Vienna to Erbil. Whoa. Because I avoided other countries where they would ask you, hey, why do you have body armor and a helmet and cameras and a GPS and a sat phone? And why is there nothing on your computer? And why do you have a new passport? And why is there nothing on your phone?
Indeed.
Mister, you are using tradecraft.
But that was just to be a savvy traveler. I'm just being a savvy traveler.
Indeed.
That's all I was doing.
Clean.
Yeah. So it worked out. I flew to Erbil and got my hotel, dropped all the right names at the airport, spoke all the right Arabic at the airport, spoke all the right Arabic and dropped all the right names at the hotel, and worked the phones, and eventually within a week, got myself a ride straight to the counterterrorism service safe house in Mosul, and then rolled for 2 weeks with the counterterrorism service and the emergency response division. I broke my blog is still online, hanging up online. If you just Google Mitch Utterback Mosul blog, you'll see my master's thesis from 2017 when I put it there. I'm working on a book about the trip, my mission to Mosul. I got a publisher already. But the book will be not just like a first-person adventure story, but it's sort of a tutorial for freelancers that want to get to a denied area and how to do it safely and come back out, the kind of prep that you need. But it's also going to be a story of the importance of working within a culture, establishing close bonds, showing respect, and then how, with no maintenance on those relationships over 8 or 9 years, in many parts of the world, they're waiting to be reactivated just because of the good impression you made so long ago. Welcomed back as brothers. As you guys from SOG, when you return and you are able to link up, or here, and if you go to Greensboro, North Carolina, and you link up with your Mountain Yard teammates, you know, it's like you never left.
Indeed.
And, my welcome back to Iraq was in great part based on the relationships that I had respectfully built 8 or 9 years earlier, and the book will talk about how important that is. So.
Well, you're also being very modest here, because you also have some amazing footage, and you did capture some interviews with those key participants that nobody else had. No other journalist even came close to.
There weren't many journalists doing what I... Well, I wasn't even a journalist.
No.
I mean, at the most basic, I was a college student.
Freelancer.
College, nobody paid me. Yeah. I was a college student working on my master's thesis. Okay, on the other hand, I was a retired Special Forces Lieutenant Colonel who had been the advisor to these commanders 9 years before.
That's amazing.
So I was an atypical college student, or as they say at the university, I was a, what's that fuzzy word they have for old people that go back to school?
Non-traditional. I was a non-traditional student. Oh, an old guy that's going back to college.
That's nice.
Oh, fascinating. And I've seen some of that footage when you spoke to Chapter 78 a few years ago.
Yeah, man.
It was fascinating. Well, yeah,
I'll let you guys know when the book finally comes out, so we'll come out back and talk about it.
We'll definitely come back and talk about some more. With that thought, we're heading down the final road here. Any final thoughts either on the early side or follow-ups here for yourself? And if not, we'll head out and wrap this thing up.
Yeah, one thing that's important to me that I would like people to know is our old veterans, older than you, older than me. You know, there are still World War II veterans alive. There are still Korean War veterans alive. There's a lot of Vietnam veterans alive. And guess what? Older people still like making friends. But older people are losing friends faster than they are making them. People are dying.
Absolutely.
I want to encourage anybody that sees a vet with a ball cap that might say World War II veteran, Korean War veteran, Vietnam veteran, go up to him or her. And not just say,
thank you for your service.
That's, you know, like that's like the PC phrase that everybody feels like they have to say. But ask questions like, hey, sir, World War II, did you serve in Europe or did you serve in the Pacific Theater?
Right.
Show a tiny bit of knowledge. That's it. If it's Korea, hey, sir, Korea, huh? Man, I'd love to buy you a coffee if you got a few minutes, you know? I'd love to hear something about what you've experienced, if you don't mind. I'm grateful for the country that we live in now because of guys like you. If you see a Vietnam vet, hey, sir, I don't want to sound corny, but I just want to say welcome home. I really appreciate you guys. And I'd love to buy you a coffee, and I'd love to hear hear some of your experiences, if you don't mind. We're a different country now. And we honor and respect and we appreciate what you did.
So I know we used to sit around in Vietnam at night and we talked about which of all the wars that we've been in, which war would be the one you would least want to participate in. It was unanimous. Korea.
Yeah, man.
Chosun Reservoir.
Yeah.
My God.
Yeah, you can't. Yeah. So that's what I would like the listeners to take away here at the end is, approach somebody with just a tiny bit of conversation in you, not just a throwaway, thank you for your service, you know?
Indeed.
Because they might be hard of hearing, and they might say, I don't have a cervix, I'm a man. You know, they said thank you for your service, not cervix. Oh.
Indeed.
So anyway, sorry to be a smartass, but...
That's right, we like it.
Engage them. Spend time with them. If they live close by, go visit. You know, assisted living facilities and VA hospitals are full of people that would like company.
Indeed.
Get off your ass and go be part of the repayment plan that our country still owes these veterans and visit them.
In that case, let me be the first to welcome you to the Old Man Veterans Club, sir.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for today.
Thanks, Tilt.
And as we close here, again, we thank Jocko Willink Productions for making all this possible. And we also thank all our service members today, our 5 service units. Of course, now we have the Space Force, so we have 6 military service units. We thank all those service members, Border Patrol, first responders, law enforcement that fight to keep our country safe. We also want to thank the men and women who have served in years past, have come home, and men like yourself that served, Mitch, was such a great honor for our country. We thank you. And last but not least, we also remember and salute the men and women who did not come home. They were POWMIAs. Thank you again. Till next time. Airborne.
They oppressively bear.
Amen.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.